Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. We begin with North Korea's controversial missile launch today. Japan issued a strong protest immediately, with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe saying it is absolutely unacceptable. He said Tokyo would remain in close touch with the United States and South Korea about developments in North Korea. The missile took a high-altitude path, indicating it might be a two-stage rocket capable of flying up to 4,500 kilometers. The launch came as U.S., Japanese, and European militaries gather for war games in the Pacific. A cyber attack against tens of thousands of data networks around the world, all infected by malware that locks computer files unless a ransom is paid. Stephen Wilson is the head of the Europol European Cyber Crime Center.
What we do at Europol, we take all the pieces of the jigsaw from the member states, from other countries, from industry, and work together with them to put the jigsaw together. Ultimately, if we can see enough of the picture, we can arrest those individuals responsible.
There's no word on who launched the plot. Computer security experts say the current attack could have been much worse, but for the quick action of a young researcher in Britain who discovered a vulnerability in the ransomware itself. Britain's National Health Service first sounded the ransomware alarm on Friday. France's new president, Emmanuel Macron, has taken the oath of office at the Élysée presidential palace in Paris. Macron takes charge of a nation that, when Britain leaves the European Union in 2019, will become the EU's only member with nuclear weapons and a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. Macron will make his first visit abroad on Monday when he heads to Germany to meet with Chancellor Angela Merkel. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. A new public opinion poll shows more Americans than not opposed President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey. The NBC Wall Street Journal survey in recent days said just 29% of those surveyed say they approve of Trump's dismissal of Comey. Trump said he fired Comey because he was not doing a good job. Trump said on Saturday he could name the new FBI director within days.
I think the process is going to go quickly because almost all of them are very well known. You know, they've been vetted over their lifetime, essentially. But very well known, highly respected, really talented people. And that's what we want for the FBI.
Nearly a dozen people are being considered, including attorneys, law enforcement officials, and lawmakers. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says he is not worried his good relationship with President Trump is falling off following Trump's firing of James Comey. Tillerson told NBC News Meet the Press Sunday he is devoted to helping the president achieve his objectives, helping him be successful, and he understands he has to earn his confidence every day with how he runs the State Department, consistent with the direction Trump wants to take the country. Tillerson spoke as Trump prepares for his first overseas trip as U.S. president with stops in Saudi Arabia, Israel, and later a visit with Pope Francis. Chinese President Xi Jinping met his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin in Beijing on Sunday on the sidelines of the Belt and Road Forum, where world leaders are exploring reopening the historic Silk Road as a way of boosting global development and expanding links between Asia, Africa, and Europe. Mr. Xi says China and Russia cited other cooperations
in implementing this corridor.
Mr. Xi went on to say, in the current complicated and changing international context, China and Russia have practiced our responsibilities as major powers and made efforts in finding political solutions to the Syrian crisis and the nuclear issue of the Korean Peninsula. We have played an important role as balancing powers in maintaining the regional and global peace and stability. She also said his country's state banks will provide tens of billions of dollars for projects that are part of his signature foreign policy initiative linking China to much of Asia, Europe, and Africa. A 5.7 magnitude earthquake hit the Iranian province of North Khorasan, killing two people and injuring at least 225 more. The Red Crescent Society said rescuers were sent to the quake-hit region immediately on Saturday. 80% of those injured and surviving that quake have been relocated into tents. I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We charged them with three cases, one for treason and another one for obstruction of the presidential motorcade, and then use of insulting language.
Detained Zambian main opposition leader accuses the government of mistreatment in prison.
Ramaphosa has been half-hearted in as far as this assignment is concerned. If you remember, the decision was made a long time ago.
Opposition political parties in the Kingdom of Lesotho express displeasure with South African Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa.
It's been done under the umbrella of the STEM Africa Initiative at Michigan. And the vision of the conference series is to alternate between an African country and Michigan every 2 years, every other year.
And we look at the upcoming Science and Technology Conference in Cameroon. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Detained Zambian main opposition leader has accused the government of mistreatment in prison. In a post to his Facebook page, Hakainde Hichilema from the United Party for National Development, or UPND, says conditions under which he is being kept are life-threatening. If convicted on treason charges, Hichilema faces a minimum jail term of 15 years. The maximum sentence is the death penalty. For the latest development about the opposition leader's prosecution, I read Charles Kakoma, spokesman for the UPND.
Well, yes, he was charged with three cases, one for treason and another one for obstruction of the presidential motorcade, and then use of insulting language. So what the state has done is to enter a nolle prosequi in one of the cases, that is obstruction of the presidential motorcade. But the interesting thing is that on one hand, the obstruction of the motorcade was being tried as a misdemeanor, a small case, which is like a traffic offense. On the other hand, the same obstruction of motorcade is being tried in another court as a treason case.
Hakainde Hichilema wrote complaining of being subjected to life-threatening conditions. What does he mean by that? And in this case, isn't he being treated just like any other prisoner? Also, should he expect anything different because he is a political leader in Zambia?
Well, he has complained that when he was arrested, he was put in a cell where there was no mattress, and he had to sleep on the floor. And the police would sometimes come and pour water on the floor so that he can't sleep. He had to stand the whole night. Last week, for example, the police tried to bundle him in a vehicle which had dog feces and urine to transport him from the courts to the prison, and he resisted, but complained that that is inhuman treatment because he cannot be made to sit in a vehicle that has feces for dogs.
The police are denying all these, that these are made up just to gain sympathy, not only from his supporters, but for the entire country as well as the international community. And this is just a published relation exercise or a stunt, as he faces very serious treasonous charges.
Yes, they can deny that, but people have seen those German shepherds at court. For the first time that the police are now taking dogs to the court, and obviously they are being transported in some vehicles. So if the people feel that is being made to board those vehicles, it justifies the HH's claim that they tried to put him in a vehicle with his feces. Besides that, he's more or less being denied basic rights like gestation rights. Many people, including senior members of his own party, are not being allowed to see him.
I've heard UPND supporters complain about what they described as the constant adjournment of the case, and they said it's a part of the plot to detain him for a very long time. But isn't this part of the Zambian legal system? Some PF cadres are saying that UPND should stop mourning and just allow the legal transparent system to continue. What do you say to that?
Well, basically, justice delayed is justice denied. And when they continue to adjourn the case, Akarinde Ichilema remains in custody. And he's not yet, he's innocent until proven guilty. So he continues to suffer. It's a punishment that he continues to suffer in prison while the cases are being adjourned. In one case of the prison, the last 1 week, it has been adjourned 3 times. The matter was supposed to come for ruling the day before yesterday. It didn't come. Now, today has also adjourned it to Monday next week. We do not know what is causing the delay, but what is obvious is that the delay is an injustice to Hakainde Ichilema.
So what is the next line of action for the UPND concerning this treason charge?
His lawyers have taken an approach that they will raise the constitutional issues of the infringement of his rights as a citizen. Those constitutional matters that they've raised, they want to take them to from the magistrate court to the high court, which has jurisdiction to hear constitutional issues, hoping that when those constitutional issues are raised in the High Court, there's a possibility that he could be discharged.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for the Zambian Main Opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Opposition political parties in the Kingdom of Lesotho have expressed disappointment after South African Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa postponed a national dialogue planned ahead of the June 3rd elections. Citing time constraints, Ramaphosa postponed the dialogue till after the poll. Lesotho will hold its third elections in 5 years after Prime Minister Pakadita Musisidi lost a no-confidence vote and subsequently dissolved parliament. Mafa Sejenemani, a political science professor at the National University of Lesotho, told me Mr. Ramaphosa has not been an effective mediator to help resolve challenges the country faces.
Ramaphosa has been half-hearted in as far as this assignment is concerned. If you remember, the decision was made a long time ago by SADC in its summit in Swaziland, but he did not come here at all until now, when you have almost 3 weeks before the elections are going to start. Therefore, there was no chance of him being able to find a solution about the dialogue, because you have to prepare for the dialogue and all those things. But because he delayed to come and probably has lost interest and is focused more on trying to stand for elections as ANC president in South Africa, I don't think that he still has the enthusiasm for this job. He's just staying because SADC said he should stay.
Do you think the rescheduling of the dialogue involving all stakeholders and political parties will have any impact at all in the June 3 elections?
It will have an impact in terms of not having ensured that there is an understanding about security during the period, because the biggest danger at the moment is that the possibility that the elections could be disrupted, or if not disrupted, you could have a situation whereby immediately after the elections, problems begin with some people refusing to accept the results of the election. The main reason why there was supposed to be this dialogue was to try to ensure that with the international support, there is a consensus on how to manage security. Secondly, to also make sure that there are certain guarantees which could be provided by SADC or other international bodies to ensure that the military and some elements within the
ruling coalition do not disrupt the elections. People are no longer talking about free or fair elections. They just want peaceful elections. And that was what really was important.
Professor Segenimani, the opposition parties appear to be very disappointed that the dialogue has been postponed or rescheduled. Is this the same feeling among the people of Lesotho?
That feeling is there for all those who understand the stakes are very high at the present time. But you see, there is also another element that, broadly speaking, you'll find that there is a lot of skepticism about Ramaphosa's mediation amongst the broader public. Therefore, some of them are not really as bothered about that. But for those who can see beyond just the emotional issue of making sure that there is no Ramaphosa around because he hasn't done anything, he hasn't been able to achieve most of the things which he was supposed to do, there is a lot of worry that this pre-election dialogue will not take place for the reasons which I've already given, that it is about ensuring that there is security, ensuring that the rogue elements who may want to disrupt the elections know that the international community is able and willing to be able to ensure that there's no bloodshed which can come in as a result of this election.
Looking at some of these concerns you've raised, do you foresee any of the stakeholders petitioning SADC to have Cyril Ramaphosa replaced perhaps?
Well, there have been people who have been talking about that, but knowing the nature of the state system which we have, there is not much hope of success doing that because SADC is an organization which largely heads of state and government body. It is not a people's organization. And there is always this scratch my back, I scratch yours syndrome, which you'll find. And as a result of that, there is not much hope for people trying to petition. But generally, when you talk to people around the country, you find that they are disillusioned with Ramaphosa's mediation. But I don't think that there is a stamina for spending a lot of energy trying to say that he should be removed because you are unlikely to succeed.
Mafa Segenimani is a political science professor at the National University of Lesotho. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. Cameroon will host the Science, Technology, Engineering and Mathematics, or STEM, conference beginning May 29. The conference is being organized by the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Speakers at the meeting would include the Cameroonian Prime Minister, heads of academic institutions, among others. Education in STEM fields has been identified as a developmental goal. This, as the African Union encourages member countries to invest in STEM research and education by spending about 1% of their GDP on STEM. For more about the upcoming conference, I reached Dr. Nkem Kumba, lecturer, Comprehensive Studies Program STEM Africa Initiative at the University of Michigan.
The University of Michigan has been hosting this conference now for the last 8 years. We had a first in Michigan in 2010. We had one in Ghana in Kumasi in 2012, one here in Michigan in 2014, and now in Cameroon. So it's been done under the umbrella of the STEM Africa Initiative at Michigan. And the vision of the conference series is to alternate between an African country and Michigan every 2 years, every other year. So this year we were going to host it in Africa, and Cameroon came out as a strong candidate as a host.
Talking about science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM, what is the significance of these in African development?
You know, most African countries are within about 60 years of their independence. In the immediate post-colonial era, the dominant people who determined Africa's post-colonial trajectory, people like Sadat Senghor, Kwame Nkrumah, Nyerere, they were primarily focused on reaffirming Africa's identity. They were primarily focused on creating state governing structures, bureaucracies to run a government that they are taking over from the Europeans. there was no primary focus on the ingredients that can actually develop the country's infrastructures. Now, if you flip on the other end, countries that have done very well in the world, the U.S., Europe, Asia now rising, have done so because they have been able to put some significant focus on developing their scientific know-how. Roads, national infrastructures, buildings, bridges, healthcare, those are all done by engineers. They are done by people who know the sciences. And if Africa is going to go beyond post-independence celebration and become emerging continent as they desire to, as you see many of the policy instruments from the African Union to national development agendas say Africa wants to become self-sufficient, then they must emphasize and pivot their developmental policies and practices towards developing the most competent and critical mass in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
So what is the current state of affairs of the teaching of science, technology, engineering, mathematics on the continent?
Well, obviously, it is not at the best compared to the rest of the world. Many Africans are doing okay, but when you compare it to the rest of the world, the developed world or the developing world, then almost every index, every indicator, you know, shows that Africa doesn't compare strongly to the rest of the world. Again, because in the last 50 years, they've focused on humanities and social sciences. Our publications, our research infrastructure, our academic curriculum. I'll give you an example. The west coast of Africa, pretty much all of Africa, but from Angola all the way on the west coast through Cameroon up to Ghana, that's entirely an oil coast. That's the source of most of Africa's GDP. But you barely have any university or any strong programs in petroleum engineering in the on the continent to empower Africans to know the engineering that they need to extract their own resources. If you look at the healthcare, for example, the Ebola incidents, the malaria, the AIDS, and all the different epidemics that have really, really impacted Africa negatively. When those things happen, Africa has to rely on the outside world to support them to be able to overcome those health challenges. Those are scientific problems that if Africa is able to develop its own advanced skills in the healthcare sector, broadly speaking, then it doesn't have to wait until there's an epidemic to go looking for help from the outside world. It can already function the way other countries handle their own health systems.
But is there any collaboration between the Western countries and Africa?
Let's distinguish two things here. Collaboration is one that is mutualizing, where two parties come on the table and they both benefit out of it. Much of the instruments that now exist between the West and Africa are one way. The West provides resources and they determine the terms of the exchange. In the end, something goes to Africa, but Africa is not empowered in the process. They are receivers of what comes to them. So what we're suggesting is that the relationship when it comes to collaboration and cooperation between the Western countries and African institutions should be more at par and more mutualizing, so that at the end of activities, the African colleagues who are part of this process are better positioned to take over and run their own affairs, as opposed to being constant recipients of what comes from outside.
Dr. Nkem Kumba is a lecturer, Comprehensive Studies Program, STEM Africa Initiative at the University of Michigan. He spoke with me from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Authorities in Tanzania say they are cracking down on school bus safety. This following a recent deadly crash on May 6 that killed 35 people, nearly all of them school children. The tragedy has revived advocacy for stricter safety rules that will help prevent future accidents. For VOA, Sophie Trembley reports from Arusha.
The skeleton of the lime green minibus lies in the Arusha traffic police yard. Its front wheels are twisted upwards, showing the force of the accident's impact. Inside, the orange benches are contorted and crushed together. The accident took the lives of 32 Tanzanian schoolchildren, as well as their two teachers and the bus driver. Arusha police hauled what remains of the school bus to their headquarters as part of an ongoing investigation. The school's owner was detained on Tuesday for questioning, but has since been released on bail. Yusuf Ilembo is the Arusha Senior Assistant Commissioner of Police.
They must have their buses good, well-checked, with good tires, and also their drivers. They must make sure that their drivers never drive the school buses when they are drunk. And they will never drive their buses with excessive speed.
The students from Lucky Vincent Primary School in Arusha were on the way to a partner school outside the city, but they never made it. Their bus plunged into a ravine. The force of the impact caused many of the seats to come undone and fly forward. Ilembo says traffic police officers have been dispatched throughout the region to check that school buses are up to code and equipped with seatbelts. Some opposition members believe bus operators need stricter routine regulation. Samson Mwigamba is a member of ACT Wazalendo.
The bus operators are aiming at maximizing profit. And what they do, they just take the old buses, which are actually so much prone to the accidents, and they hire even the not much qualified drivers.
Lucky Vincent is one of the top-rated elementary schools in the region. Students and teachers are still trying to grapple with what happened as families hold funerals for the victims. VOA spoke to Headmaster Ephraim Jackson.
We can say that there could be the national disaster. And everybody received in this in a very sad way. The regional commissioner said that he can also prepare a very good program on how that the pupils, I mean staff, that can be cancelled.
The school has launched an online donation page aimed at raising about $22,000 to help the families who lost their children. Three American medical volunteers who witnessed Saturday's crash and helped rescue three survivors are now trying to bring the children to the United States for treatment. They've visited the children in hospital every day since the crash, says Kevin Niegard, one of the volunteers.
Every time it's been a little more reassuring. They're getting healthier and healthier, but they still have multiple injuries that need really significant care.
Their organization, the Siouxland Tanzania Education Medical Ministries, or STEM, says it will cover the cost of the children's surgeries in the U.S. Sophie Tremblay for VOA News, Arusha.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, what does the future hold for Liberia? Who will lead the West African nation when President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf leaves office in October at the end of her second term? 2 million Liberians have registered to vote, and nearly half of those are women. What's at stake in Liberia? On the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The FIFA Council has ratified the decision to give Africa 9 automatic places when the World Cup expands to 48 teams in 2026. The move was confirmed on Tuesday in Bahrain. The continent currently has 5 spots at the tournament. The 10th African country will take part in a six-nation playoff tournament to decide the last 2 spots. The expanded World Cup will feature 16 teams from Europe, 8 teams from Asia, Africa will have 9, North and Central America will have 6, South America will have 6, Oceania 1, and the final 2 places in 2026 will be decided by 6-team playoffs. Meanwhile, in African football, holders Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa and record 8 times winners Al Ahly of Egypt were both surprisingly held to a goalless draw at home at the start of their African Champions League group campaigns. Sundowns drew 0-0 with Ethiopia's St. George on Saturday as Ahly suffered the same score against Zanaco of Zambia. Sundowns, who defeated Zamalek in the 2016 final to lift the trophy, found it difficult to break down an impressive St. George defense in Pretoria. The hosts dominated play, squandering several good scoring chances, including one for Sibusiso Vilakazi during the second half when he shot wide. St. George, who defended in depth, had Ugandan goalkeeper Robert Odongo Karak thank after he made several fine saves. St. George, the first club from Ethiopia to make the group phase, won all 4 of their qualifiers and will be looking to continue that form in the remaining games of the group phase. Later on Saturday night, a record 8-time champions Al Ahly of Egypt drew 0-0 with Zanaco of Zambia in Alexandria in Group D. In other matches, Tol du Sahel beat Ferroviario Vieira 5-0. Al Ahly drew with Al Merrikh 1-1. Esperance beat AS Vita Club 3-1. US Algar beat Al Ahly Tripoli 3-0. Zamalek beat Caps United 2-0. And Wydad Casablanca beat Cotton Sport 2-0. The Champions League group phase has been expanded from 8 clubs to 16 this season. And the new Confederation of African Football, CAF president, Ahmed, says he will not accept a salary from African football's governing body. His election in March ended Cameroonian Issa Hayatou's 29-year reign. The 57-year-old from Madagascar held his first senior CAF meetings on Monday ahead of the FIFA Congress on Thursday. Discussing how to reform CAF, Ahmed says there's much work to be done in lots of areas, in his words, to make CAF work as it should. He voiced concerns about the popularity of their flagship Africa Cup of Nations tournament, saying it's in danger of being overshadowed by the African Nations Championship, CHAN, which is for locally based players. Ahmed also wants to look at the reinvestment of CAF resources to aid the development of football across the continent, stressing that CAF is not here to make money to enrich itself. And finally, in tennis, 4-time champion Rafael Nadal ended a 3-year, 7-match losing streak against Novak Djokovic to reach the final of the Madrid Open. The Spaniard won 6-2, 6-4 to claim his first victory over the Serb since the 2014 French Open final. Nadal improved his record on clay this year, 14-0, and will face Australian Dominic Thiem, who beat Uruguay's Pablo Cuevas 6-4, 6-4 in Sunday's final. Kristina Mladenovic plays Simona Halep in Saturday's women's final. Nadal confirmed his return to form with a long-awaited win over Djokovic, his 24th in 50 career meetings. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. If we remember, baby.
Take a plan, yeah. Take a plan, yeah. in the red the scriptures. Holy word in your mouth. Baby, what that preacher man said was not something that was within you. Now I know what they mean when they say. Beautiful woman, with another man's blessing. Oh Lord, I'm ready. This choice I made, it didn't work out the way I thought it would.
You already know all that I eat again. You already know is the tunes again. Oh, you are teasing, yeah. Shun teasing, na na na, yeah, yeah, woo, yeah. Go my road, girl, you carry over load. I fight, girl, no be so. Cause my pocket heavy, oh. See, go my road, girl, you carry over load. I fight, girl, no be so. Cause my pocket heavy.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Increasingly, Somalia is being recognized as a pressing problem. This is a far cry from the days in the early 1990s when former Secretary General Boutros Ghali criticized the international community for tackling the rich man's war in the Balkan while ignoring the poor man's war in Somalia. Incidentally, it was under the auspices of Secretary General Boutros Ghali that the first attempt was made internationally to tackle the collapse of Somalia following the military coup d'etat against Said Barre, the president. Nowadays, there is recognition that because of the strategic location of Somalia, the need to combat poverty and terrorism, and the need to preserve the trade routes in the Indian Ocean, much attention should be paid in that country. Because of this reason, there have been many attempts by neighboring countries, by the African Union, to assist Somalia. And last week, for the third time since 2012, an international conference was held at Lancaster House in London, which was attended by 40 participants, many at the very highest level. The conference was opened by Prime Minister May of the United Kingdom and other high-level attendees, including Defense Minister of the United States in the conference. It would appear that this time the main focus was on the security issues, since Somalia had to sign an agreement at the end of the conference on a security pact. The intention is to undertake security reforms, particularly building the army of Somalia and police. It is expected that next year, in 2018, the African Union peacekeeping force may withdraw and the security issues should be assumed by the Somali army. This will be a very, very tall order. The president of Somalia, who took office in February, said at the end of the conference that he was very pleased with the results and he called it a historic occasion. But President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed also appealed to the conference to lift the embargo on Somalia, which was imposed by the Security Council in the early 1990s. He said that should the Council fail to do that, then the war in Somalia may continue for another decade. Earlier, he had said that with a reformed army in Somalia, he would be able to defeat al-Shabaab in 2 years. As you all know, al-Shabaab is affiliated to al-Qaeda and has been the major security threat to Somalia. Even though al-Shabaab had been moved away from the major cities, it still is very strong in the rural areas. And from time to time, it has launched attacks in Somalia, causing many civilian threats. So this is an urgent task for any government in Somalia. The question of lifting the embargo is problematic for some of the Security Council members. The Foreign Minister of the United Kingdom said it would be difficult to agree to lift the embargo because of concern that flow of arms to Somalia might fall into the arms of al-Shabaab, which is a threat to the security of the people of Somalia. Another issue raised by the Secretary General of the UN, Antonio Guterres, who also attended, is the drought and poverty of Somalia. He appealed for an additional pledge of $900 million to make it a total of $1.5 billion to deal with the drought situation now taking place in Somalia. Again, the response to the appeals have been slow, and unless this is done urgently, this may be an additional problem for Somalia. Now, it is recognized that there has been much progress in Somalia in the security field. There's much more stability. And in fact, in this improved situation, you do have a competition by many major powers for influence in the country. Turkey is promoting trade and building mosques. The UK is strongly involved. So is Egypt. And the US just few weeks ago sent security forces to help train the Somali army. But what has been left out are two key aspects. One, no attempt is being made seriously to explore the issue of negotiations, conflict resolution. Is it possible to have some kind of accommodation with al-Shabaab? This should be explored. The other matter which is urgent is to make the building blocks for democracy in Somalia. At present time, election is based on the clan system, but you cannot have stability in any country if you do not bring in the people of the country. So these are two things which have to be pursued and pursued actively before the withdrawal of the African Union troops in Somalia. Even when all of these things have been done, there is no guarantee that Somalia will become stable. In the past, there have been too many optimistic statements of ending the conflict in Somalia, only to be disappointed. So much more should be done in these two crucial areas of building democracy and conflict resolution. I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, what nature gives us is not refused. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
United Nations peacekeeping missions are critical to assisting war-torn countries get back on their feet and to transition from conflict to peace. For over 60 years now, UN peacekeeping missions have operated in some of the most dangerous and difficult environments in the world, dealing with conflicts and their aftermath the world over. In that time, 126 countries have contributed peacekeepers to the United Nations. Given the wide spectrum of cultures involved, in order to be successful in their common endeavor, they must train together. Now more than ever, there is a growing global demand for trained peacekeeping personnel, writes Andrew Strike of the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs in a recent blog post. International stability requires peace operations, and peace operations require well-trained, effective peacekeepers. That is why in late March and early April, the government of Nepal and the United States Pacific Command co-hosted Shanti Pious III, a multinational peacekeeping exercise that brought together participants from over 30 countries. Partnerships play a critical role in meeting global challenges, from maintaining peace to providing humanitarian assistance after natural disasters, said U.S. Ambassador to Nepal, Elena Teplitz. This kind of multinational training can deepen mutual understanding and respect and encourage further collaboration if we're doing it right and we're committed to this mission. The Shanti Pious III, which translates as Peace Endeavor, is supported by the U.S. Global Peace Operations Initiative, a U.S. government-funded security assistance program that aims to strengthen international peacekeeping capacity in support of United Nations and regional peace operations. The initiative provides the capacity-building support to help countries around the world contribute to the establishment of international peace and security. The United States is committed to UN peacekeeping missions, mandates, and tasks that support the rules-based international order, a system that benefits all nations, said Admiral Harris, head of U.S. Pacific Command. That's why we continue to work together with partners from the countries represented at Shanti Pious III.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.